Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on today's edition, we're going to take a look at a few headlines. Also, top story at thetrumpet.com and see what's coming up on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. Also, on this day in history, interesting note about the United Nations. And continue to look at a really important book, Russia and China in Prophecy, looking at the second chapter today about Russia and what they've been up to over the last few years. Very interesting. That and more on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. Any emails you'd like to send, go ahead and send those to comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk with you here today, along with Grant Turgeon. Welcome back. It's been a while.
It's been a really long time.
Yeah. You've been you went on a global escapade, so you've returned, and it takes. We were talking about the jet lag. It takes a while to get back to the normal central time in the United States when you've been in different time zones.
Right, I got back on Thursday. Yet Friday through yesterday, actually Friday through today, I'd been waking up at 2 or 2:30 every single day. And today I finally just forced myself to stay in bed and eventually fell back asleep.
You know, I always wonder why it is. It seems like, anyway, for me, that even if I can't sleep and I stay in bed and lay there, it seems like I shouldn't be as tired, but for some reason laying there doesn't seem to do anything.
That's right.
I don't know. There's always that debate. Should you just get up and get busy with something, or should you lay there? I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. Today I was actually able to will myself back to sleep, so it wasn't like I was just laying there thinking or doing nothing. I actually fell back to sleep, which was necessary because I hadn't slept through the night in a couple of weeks being over in England, being over in Israel. It just wasn't working out that well.
Yeah. Now that you have a child, do you find that you have more in your mind, like it's harder to sleep?
Not really. Yeah. I don't stress about Loma very much because my wife is diligent, and so I don't have to worry too much about that.
Yeah, well, that's good. Lots of interesting things to look at today, including this first story here from Fox News. It's interesting. It's a local story for Oklahoma City, but it speaks to a national issue. And this is Oklahoma City to rename schools that are named after Confederate generals. It's a big controversy. It says officials in Oklahoma's largest city voted unanimously Monday to rename three elementary schools named after Confederate generals, becoming the latest district to do so. So they, I guess not too many people wanted to go the other way from the popular opinion. That would have been an interesting debate. I wish they would debate that publicly. I would actually like to just hear both sides of the argument.
You would like to hear especially the side that is trying to rename everything and erase history, because they don't have much of an argument. Mainly it's just agitating and protesting and tearing things down. You don't hear much of a coherent argument at all from that side.
There's a lot of things that are sort of being decided socially or politically without a lot of open conversation back and forth that doesn't descend into just a yelling and argumentative. But in this case, the Oklahoma City Public Schools School Board voted 7-0 to change the names of the Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Isaac Stand Waite, I believe. I'm not sure if I said that right. Schools. And they said, as the district begins the input process to determine the names of these facilities will bear moving forward, I hope to use it as a teachable moment for our students and to establish a positive image and a sense of pride for these school communities to carry them into the future, according to the superintendent name there. So anyway, it's going to cost, for some reason, it's going to cost $40,000. I guess they need new signs. Maybe they'll have to change some things legally. I don't know. Anyway, it's going to cost about $40,000 to rename all three schools. and they hope they can raise enough money to pay for the changes without using additional district resources. They should pay for it with Confederate funds.
It's such a threat today. We have to still worry about the fallen Confederacy. Yeah, it just that vote just seemed like it was either motivated by fear or ignorance. It's one of the two, because obviously there is a very vocal minority of the country that wants to change all of these historical points, and then there's the majority that is fearful of the minority and wants to go along with it so that they're not called racist.
It seems, yeah, it seems like that. The only dissenter here is Larry Logan with the Sons of the Confederate Veterans. He told Fox 25 the group was very disappointed by the decision, but changing taking the names off the buildings won't erase the legacy of the three generals, he said. He said it's not going to change with who those three men were. They're still honorable men, and it's not going to change who we are. We are descendants of Confederate soldiers, and that's who we are, he said, and it's not going to change that. So lots of opinions there. I guess my question would be, I would just like to know more about what the main reason for changing the names is. I think what the emotional argument is about racism and slavery and that, but I'd like to hear a little bit more. I don't even know enough about the history of these guys, honestly, to make an educated have an educated thought about it. But I was reading this book about Abraham Lincoln. It's just a great book about him. And when he was dealing with the slavery issue, which was an actual issue at the time, of course, he was very careful to not form his opinion or speak out on the side of either side that was very emotional about it. Even though personally he wanted an end to slavery, there were some people at the time that were just being very emotional and sort of even violent in what they were doing. And he made a conscious effort to try to not get emotional, but just look at the logic and the reason and not be influenced by emotion, because there's a lot of emotion on both sides. So with something like this, I think that would be a good course to take and say, okay, well, both sides have really strong emotion, understandably, I guess. How about what's the reason or the logic? Like, I'd like to hear more about these generals and what they did and what their lives were like and the historical context, and have a well thought out and a well delivered, you know, change the names or don't change them. Let's hear both sides, and then maybe people could decide. But I just don't feel like there's enough of that debate going on.
Well, especially when you consider it's going to cost $40,000 to change the names. It hasn't been clearly stated how this is going to be a benefit to any of those students in those schools. By all accounts I've read, at least Robert E. Lee, if not those other two generals, was a man of sterling character, a devoted husband, a committed father. He fought for the cause of the Confederacy, which it's been stained today as if the Confederacy is only equal to racism, when the reality of that history and that time period clearly shows that people in both the Confederacy and the Union thought in a pretty bad way about black people back then. They thought of black people as less than human. That was pervasive throughout the entire country. That's also revealed by Abraham Lincoln's statement about the war, that sin from both sides, we hear a lot of controversy when anyone points out the fault of both sides today, but sin on both sides is what caused that war. He didn't just point out that the Confederacy was evil and the Union was righteous and had to whip the Confederacy back into shape. It was sin on both sides that caused the war. Both sides also had elements of it that you could praise and look to in history and learn from.
And it seems, too, that as the U.S. is having these internal squabbles and tearing down our history and kind of blotting out history, other nations aren't doing that. They're becoming, you know, even more nationalistic, I would say. You know, I don't see Russia taking down any statues or, you know, some of these other nations. They seem to be going back to their roots and having a real pride in it. So anyway, it's an interesting situation here. I don't know what they're going to rename them. I guess that'll be open to some sort of consideration there. Name after an animal, maybe.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just this whole movement isn't very well thought through. I mean, it seemed like for about 2 weeks this was the biggest issue in the news, trying to tear down Confederate monuments nationwide. It's sort of faded away because what you see from this radical left communist movement. They just tear one thing down and then they rampage on to the next thing. Now we're hearing this come back up again, but it's not really something that any of those people care that much about, or else we'd hear more of an outcry about it for a more sustained period of time, not just for about 2 weeks.
It's kind of a slippery slope, too. I mean, if everything that has a name, that has a historical context, was like put under the magnifying glass of did they ever do anything wrong, you couldn't name anything. I mean, right? Because everybody's made their mistakes.
It would all have to be named after Jesus Christ. That'd be it.
Right, yeah, exactly. So interesting story there. That's from Fox News, Oklahoma City to rename schools named after Confederate generals. So we'll see what they come up with there to rename them. I know in Wisconsin they renamed a lot of schools too because of the backlash against Indian names. And I think in most cases it was pretty general. It was like animals, I think, that they named them after.
Yeah, you just kind of have to go beyond the human realm to avoid offending anybody at some point. And that just shows you how extreme political correctness is, that we have to just tiptoe around every little issue. There are parts of all cultures that are worth praising and that are worth memorializing in the name of a school or whatnot. And to act like entire groups of people deserve to be uniformly scorned and that you can't even bring out a single aspect of any of them to praise, that's just ignorant and that's not reality at all.
I saw one a comedy sketch, I guess it was, where they were trying to rename a team. This was years ago. They were kind of making light of how everything had to be renamed, and I think they came up with the Players. Like, that was their name. They were the Players. They couldn't name the sports team after anything, so they just called them, like, the Players, or maybe it was even, like, the Humans or something, just sort of this very vague thing. So, anyway, I forget what the mascot was. I think it was, like, a silhouette of a human, but it was kind of hard to figure out.
You couldn't make it lean too much toward either gender, probably. So,
no.
Yeah, that just highlights how ridiculous and absurd this movement can be, where there's a conception that every single change is a good change. A lot of time, it costs a lot of time, it costs a lot of money, it divides a lot of people. Just to change something where they can't even name the benefits of making that particular change.
I think they should name the schools after Russell Westbrook. How about that?
There you go. Every day is Russell Westbrook Day in Oklahoma anyway.
Name them after the different Thunder players. Top story, thetrumpet.com today. North Africa is suffering its own 9/11s, plural. It says, and the West barely notices. We shouldn't let it go ignored. That's by Kieran Underwood. And he says, one little line from him, in short, radical Islam has a presence in North Africa that makes America's worries look like a walk in the park. So they're dealing with that all the time. And it seems like, I don't know, once a week, I don't want to overstate it, but there's some sort of a blast and people are killed and destroyed. And, you know, it's easy to look at it and say, oh, that's, you know, North Africa. It's par for the course. But I mean, if you think about those things happening here in the U.S. or something, or in your neighborhood, you know, it's earth shattering, you know, for those people. And yet it's not getting a lot of attention.
Well, think about the coverage that we had on that attack in San Bernardino, California, where it seemed like maybe a radical Islamist had done that attack. That killed 14 people in California, and yet it was a huge story in our news. A lot of time, though, our news doesn't seem to look past our own borders, because routinely, as in Somalia a couple weeks ago, well over 200 people were killed in a single radical Islamist terrorist attack. It happens all the time over there, and I don't know too much about it, but I'm sure that a large portion of Somalians are also Muslim. So it's like they're pretty indiscriminate in how they attack and whom they attack. They even cannibalize a lot of their own, because their belief is that those people who are victimized will also be rewarded in the afterlife.
It's they're a real pariah on the world stage. It seems like every nation has problems with Islamic attacks. So anyway, really interesting write up there today. Check that out at thetrumpet.com. Related to that is Watch Algeria by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, and The King of the South by him as well. Really a good write-ups to look at. A little further down on thetrumpet.com, really interesting story, how World War III will start. It's not a question, it's a statement. The greatest event in mankind's history is about to take place. And, of course, that ends with Christ's return, which is that great event that we're looking forward to. But there is a lot of trouble there. before that. And related to that is Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. That's a new booklet, again, by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. Make sure you get that. Really important write-ups there. Also on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host Stephen Fleury talks a little bit about some of that. Matthew 24, if you're familiar with that passage, talks a lot about what you can expect to see before Christ returns. That's what his disciples asked him, as a matter of fact. What shall be the sign of your coming and the end of the world? How much do you know about Matthew 24? Take a look at that and see Christ said there. That's talked about today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host Stephen Fleury. Laid out a lot of interesting things to look towards there in Matthew 24. And if you look to the world news and you kind of understand a little bit about that, you can see a lot of those dominoes beginning to fall.
That's exactly right. It does seem like every single day there are probably a few dozen headlines that tie in directly to prophetic events, whether it is a terrorist attack or a weather disaster or division within our Western Anglo-Saxon nations. A lot of these things are specifically prophesied, and a lot of people probably would criticize that, but you have to look at the fruits and see that clearly what the Bible is foretelling is actually coming to pass.
Yeah, and one of the things, of course, mentioned is wars and rumors of wars that would happen over the years, and there's been quite a few. And that ties into something that happened on this day in history, October the 24th. The United Nations was established on October the 24th, 1945. The UN was formally established less than a month after the end of World War II. The charter was ratified by China, France, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, the United States, and by a majority of other signatories. So that was a big a moment, an event, and of course they hope that the United Nations would bring some sort of peace to the world after World War II, and that was their hope at the time. I've got an audio clip, about 4-minute clip. It's kind of interesting. It's from a longer film, a 20-minute film. You can find it on YouTube if you're interested. It's called Now the Peace, Formation of the United Nations and League of Nations. And it's interesting to listen to this from 1945 and some of what they were hoping to accomplish with the United Nations. We'll go ahead and play that now.
Once again, within our time and generation, the nations face the solemn challenge history has thrust upon them, to build, amid the parting clouds of war, a peace which shall be real and indivisible. Still vivid in the mind of millions is that other victory that was to end all wars. Still vivid, those spectacles of 27 years ago, when the men came marching home to a world made safe for democracy. Still vivid, too, that figure with its mighty dream of human justice, Woodrow Wilson, prophet of the peace, whose honor spread like wildfire across tormented Europe. Wilson, who called upon the world to renounce war forever as a means of settling disputes. And many there are who recall the hope that greeted the founding of the League of Nations with its great new concept of collective security against attack. For surely a new understanding had dawned when so many nations could declare, if any member of the League resorts to war, it shall be deemed to have committed an act of war against every other member. And they recall as well how there slowly dawned instead the bitter truth that in a world of deeds, the only weapons of the League were words. Once again, within our time and generation, the nations face the solemn challenge. The things for which we fought, said Wilson, are certain to prevail. They may come in a better way than we propose. At Dumbarton Oaks, near Washington, in August 1944, a conference took place among the four major allies of the Second World War. The purpose of their meeting was to prepare for submission to all the United Nations a tentative plan for the future maintenance of peace. And from these discussions, there has emerged a blueprint for a new international organization based this time not only on ideals, but on the sober realities that lie ahead. The post-war world this plan envisages will be composed of separate sovereign states. Among them will be the United Nations, first members of the new organization. And among these, in turn, there will be five great powers, the Big Four and France. Like the League of Nations, the new world body will have a general assembly. But the actual task of peacekeeping will be in the hands of a smaller Security Council, of which the five great powers will be permanent members.
So some interesting audio there from, that was a film from 1945, talking about the United Nations. And formation, the film was called Now the Peace, Formation of the United Nations and the League of Nations. And as Grant and I were listening to that, we were marveling at that guy's voice. Everything's, you know, you those guys, everything sounds so epic when they say it. Yeah. Just amazing. But some of the points he brought out were kind of interesting. It's always interesting to look at something that happened many years ago and how it starts out with a lot of excitement and a lot of hope for the future. And then now here we are, you know, more than 50 years beyond that. And we can look back and see how successful it was. According to freedomoutpost.com, the United Nations was created to prevent wars, of course. Since then, there's been 150 wars and over 100 million casualties.
Right. Yeah, it does seem like the United Nations serves as a prime example of human nature, starting out on a ambitious course with full passion and fire, but then eventually it fizzles out and it just descends into bickering and division in that body of member groups and or group members. So I think that does show you what human nature is capable of. It's not going to solve any of mankind's problems. It's going to just try to focus on self. A lot of those nations use the United Nations as a platform to spew hatred against Israel, for example, or they're always trying to advance their own national self-interest. Clearly, a lot of those nations don't care too much about world peace unless they are the one nation dominating the rest of the world and imposing that peace.
Yeah, if you look at the nations that, or the, you know, the five, I guess, there, United States, Great Britain, France, Soviet Union, China, for the most part, they have disagreements. The U.S. and Great Britain, of course, were more aligned there for years, but France is sort of, you know, they do different things. And Soviet Union and China, they definitely are not aligned with the West in any way. So just the fact that they're called the United Nations, it's a nice hope. But you really, I guess it should be called the nations acting in their own self-interest, but trying to pretend to have a show of unity. But that's a longer title. People wouldn't like that as much.
Too honest of a title. It's not enlightening and encouraging enough. Herbert W. Armstrong is actually at, wasn't he at the very first meeting in San Francisco? Or it was one of the first ones.
Some of the meetings right around that time.
Yeah. And he kind of described how there was a buzz of excitement around the whole event and how people were talking big about creating some sort of a government or some sort of a world alliance that would actually impose peace on the world. And yet he proclaimed decisively right then that it would never happen.
Right. It can't, because there's still human nature. There's still Satan as the god of this world, which it talks about in 2 Corinthians 4:4 and Revelation as well. And so, you know, you have just that evil that's running around out there. And we were even talking about just in some of the headlines from the Trumpet. I mean, there, you know, you have religious fighting and blowing up places in Northern Africa, and it just continues on and on. So even though we haven't had a world war since World War II, there's been over 150 wars, or I guess 150. That number's probably changing all the time, and over 100 million casualties. So if that's your peacetime, you know, that doesn't say too much.
And in a lot of those 150 wars, UN peacekeeping troops have been sent there, and obviously they're not accomplishing the job of their job title, keeping the peace. It's not working out very well. Mr. Armstrong also talked about how a lot of these leaders did warn of the threat of nuclear destruction, but that the way to solve it was through one world government. But then he broke it down into practical examples. Like, could you ever imagine America willingly submitting to communist Russia and letting Russia rule the entire world and impose that peace? Or vice versa, could you ever imagine Russia submitting to America willingly? Clearly, if one nation is going to submit to another nation, and all of these other nations are going to submit to that one nation, it's going to take a world war for that to happen. All the nations are not going to agree to willingly come under the government of one nation. All these different nations are not going to send leaders to a new world government and then have them all coexist peacefully in leading the world. It just could never happen. And he was very practical and logical about explaining that.
Yeah, there would never be fair representation from all of them. There's always going to be somebody that has the advantage or is trying to take the advantage. So, even those nations that I talked about a little bit yesterday, this write-up that I saw about China and how they are looking at the politics in the U.S. and they're seeing that the U.S. is very weak. And so they're kind of reacting to that by even becoming more authoritarian in their nation. And so you can't have what happens is if you get a nation in power, in most cases they just really clamp down on the people, you know. Mm-hmm. And China's doing that today even more so, because they see that when people have a freedom, I guess, and they abuse it, you have the United States. So a lot of nations are looking at the U.S. and saying, well, that's fallen apart, so we're going to keep going with our authoritarian thing. Even though, you know, we tell them, hey, you know, you need more human rights, you need all these different things that I guess the United Nations would sort of espouse that type of thinking. They know to keep things under wraps and going the way they want, they have to be more authoritarian.
That's right. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has also brought that out as well, how these nations look at millionaire athletes in America kneeling for the anthem, and they salivate. They look at tearing down Confederate monuments, and they start dreaming of conquering America. He's also described those types of nations like Russia and China and Germany at the right time under the right leader as sharks circling in the water. So we can try to criticize those nations all we want to and point out their human rights violations or point out their flaws, but they don't care. They're sharks. They're looking to dominate the entire world. And a lot of times that purpose is hidden under the surface, but at the right time in the right place, they would gladly pounce and try to conquer America.
You saw, I suppose, that speech last week in China where President Xi there spoke for 3.5 hours. Can you imagine sitting in a 3.5 hour speech? And everyone had the printout, and they had to read it with him as he went through it, page wow. after page after page. And if nothing illustrates an authoritarian regime, or maybe nothing illustrates it better than that.
That would be about close to 100 pages.
Oh, man.
Probably 70 or 80 pages of typed out word-for-word notes. So that just and a lot of it, wasn't he point-blank saying that they hope to dominate the world? I mean, it is coming out now, and it's no coincidence that at the very same time, America is on the decline. Could you imagine China ever just outright saying something like that unless America was not there to check them?
Yeah, the headlines, you know, people say very clearly China is wanting to challenge the West, so they're not making any secret about it. And that leads right into what we're going to talk about for the rest of the program today. This really great book that you need to get at thetrumpet.com. It's updated pretty recently. Russia and China in Prophecy. Yesterday we talked about Chapter 1, which has a lot to do with China. And today the second chapter has to do with Russia. The title is Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. Russia has definitely been on the rise over the last few years. We hear about them in the news all the time, colluding apparently with different people, I guess. But they're doing a lot of things right out there in the open, and no one's stopping them at this point.
Yeah, we have recently in this country experienced a fervor and really a mass paranoia about what Russia has been doing in regards to the U.S., and yet for a long time they have been spying around the world, and they have been trying to exert influence. They've been having outright military conquests of nearby nations. Clearly, we are kind of getting involved with that because people don't like the outcome of the last election, but Russia has carried out a lot of atrocities over time, especially even recently. You see with Vladimir Putin and a lot of his political opponents ending up poisoned, or they disappear, or they're imprisoned. There are some issues there that deserve a lot more attention than whatever happened in the last election.
Yeah, and if we're going to talk about collusion, just as an aside, you know, check some of the universities. Some of like what they're teaching there. It's pretty close to communist ideology.
Yeah.
The book says in this chapter too, for over a decade after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, Russia was outside the mainstream of world affairs, but under the leadership of Vladimir Putin, who became president in 2000, things have changed radically, and they certainly have. Putin has called the Soviet Union's collapse the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. I don't know who else thinks that's true, but he certainly does. Says he has dedicated himself to reversing that quote-unquote catastrophe and restoring Russia to what he sees as its rightful position as a formidable world power. And he's done, I mean, you have to hand it to him, he's done a tremendous job. They are definitely a formidable power today.
Yes, and it is fascinating just to look into Vladimir Putin's background as a KGB spy and how someone just completely dedicated to the empire, regardless of its human rights abuses and its brutality and the things that we in the West like to criticize them for. He was devoted to their cause, advancing communism, taking over Asia, as this booklet also brings out, especially in that first chapter, and then eventually even taking over the world. So he is now the leader of the country. It seems like he has taken the power and kept the power in a lot of not so above board ways. And he's going to be a leader there probably for a very long time.
Yeah, he's tightened his vice grip on power. The book says, as we have seen with Putin's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula just a few years ago, territories in Georgia and Moldova, he has already been very successful, but he isn't finished. And so when you look at some of those recent takeovers, annexations, nobody has stopped him in any way. And I suppose he's probing and testing and seeing how far can I go before somebody will stop me or do something. And, you know, there's always talks of sanctions and so forth, but I don't think anyone's going to get in his way militarily. At least there's been no indication of that yet.
Right. How have we responded? For example, I believe it was 2008 when he invaded Georgia. Our president, George W. Bush, issued a pretty strong statement. I'm not really sure what else he did beyond that. And that does show you that we have a lot of ignorance when it comes to the mindset of Russia and some of these other nations. We think that they will listen to us. If we condemn them in the strongest terms, we think that's enough to somehow force them to change their mind, or at least not to do what they have just done that we disagreed with. They only respond to strength, and that's actually brought out in the first chapter as well from a plain truth quote. They respond to strength. They don't respond to diplomacy. They don't respond to flowery rhetoric. They only respond to strength, a determined force to oppose them and prevent them from doing the same thing again.
Yeah, and you see that even in the nation itself of Russia. Well, you mentioned some of the media before. You know, there's a lot of books out there that you can read. There's one that I read a few years ago about a little bit about his history, and it's kind of hard to pin a lot of it down. He's a little bit of a slippery guy. But there are definitely some, if nothing else, you could say mysterious disappearances and deaths of people that were critical of him in his own nation. And so when you talk about not responding to words, you know, they don't respond to it other than to shut you up if they can do so. And he really took over the media there in Russia. And a lot of people thought that after 91 that, you know, okay, we're going to become this sort of democracy. And they learned pretty quickly after Putin came to power that that's not the case.
Well, that is a nation that is being led by a man who has killed hundreds, perhaps thousands of people, either directly or indirectly, as a spy or as the leader of the nation. So he is an evil human being. That's not just a way of defaming political opposition like we see in this country all the time. The things that he has done show that he is an evil, dangerous man. The outcry against Vladimir Putin is justified as long as you're actually doing it for the right motivations. He is a dangerous person for the U.S. to go up against. But just to focus all of our outrage against him on whether or not he influenced an election, and to this point there hasn't been any proof of that, is very narrow-minded, and it shows that maybe our priorities aren't right. We care more about a Democrat not winning the presidential election than we care about the hundreds and thousands of people he's actually killed.
Right. The issue really isn't about whether or not I don't think the left or the media is really concerned whether or not Russia colluded or, you know, got involved in the election, because I think they probably do with everyone. They probably did it with the Democrats too. It's just a matter of trying to use it for political advantage. Meanwhile, though, you know, Russia is legitimately rolling into other nations and taking over, and nothing's been done about that. And I that's something that is not brought up enough in the media. There's so much collusion talk. I'd really like to hear more about what Russia has done, you know, in the recent years in Ukraine and other places, and what, you know, if that's okay, is that acceptable in the U.S.'s eyes? Right? And if it's not, what are we going to do about it? And do we expect him to stop and be content there? We don't hear a lot about that.
Yeah, and Russia has been masterful at sort of expanding its reach and advancing its global objectives, while at the same time giving our weak leadership an out. For example, when they went into Crimea, those soldiers didn't have Russian flags on their uniforms. So people could easily say, well, I don't know, it probably was Russia, but we're not really sure. We don't want to retaliate directly in case it was just some separatist movement within Russia that attacked. So it did seem like President Obama seized on that a little bit, and it wasn't completely blatant in your face, the Russian flag on the uniform. So we can't exactly strike back militarily.
Well, there's a lot of weakness in the U.S., and it's brought out in a lot of the writings at thetrumpet.com, but it gets back to sin. When there's sin, there's weakness, and nobody wants to go to war, I mean, one way or the other, but there's a time where nations do have to take a stand, and the U.S. isn't willing to do that, and I think other nations see that. This book goes on to say, Russia and China in Prophecy, that in parliamentary elections in 2003, President Putin cemented control over Russia in a way that recalled the nation's authoritarian history. I mean, he learned probably from some of the best. It says, we should remember that Mr. Putin was shaped and molded by the infamous KGB, the ruthless, murderous secret service arm of the Russian government that succeeded Joseph Stalin's secret police. Clearly, Putin had used his presidential powers to manipulate the process to ensure a victory for his United Russia Party. His strong arm move struck intense fear in Europe. And there's so much written about that. The external watchdog groups that look at the elections, they all said, there's strong arm tactics going on there. But again, it's like, well, stop me. You know, I mean, what's anybody going to do about it?
Yeah. And a lot of the most heinous part about this is like the way he has, he's been aggressive toward other nations that even America has promised to protect, like Ukraine. Like Poland, we have said to Ukraine specifically, if you give up your nuclear weapons, we'll defend you. That didn't happen. He rolled right into Crimea, which is a region of Ukraine, and he took it. So really what he is doing is he is showing the weakness of the West, exposing that we're not willing to keep our promises and defend some of these vulnerable nations on Russia's borders. And then even within the country, like you said, he is only in power and he's won so many elections because these elections aren't necessarily real elections. Who knows how they would have turned out if they were true, free, democratic, and fair elections? Maybe he wouldn't even be the leader anymore if he was even willing to give up power at all and leave office if he had lost the election. But there's even been some disturbing reports that he possibly was behind some terrorist attacks across his own country that he blamed on the Chechens.
Right.
He blamed it on them and said that they were the ones perpetrating all these attacks so that he could then take more government power and go on the attack against them. It looks like he was the one who was actually carrying those attacks out. So it shows you, even if he has to sacrifice the lives of some of his own people to get more power, he'll gladly do it.
Yeah, very, very shady dealings over there. And there's a lot written about it in many, many sources. One of the great assets that Russia has, one of their weapons, really, their most strategic asset is oil. And the Russia and China in Prophecy points out that from the beginning, Mr. Putin has sought to control that asset. No matter how much Western powers thundered in protest, the soaring price of oil from 2003 through 2008 thrust Russia back on the world stage as a dominant power. One thing that they do have is they have land and they have resources, lots and lots of it. And so Vladimir Putin went about seizing control of Russian oil and assets. And, you know, also, if you look at his personal history, which, again, is a little sketchy, but he got a lot of great wealth personally by similar methods after the Soviet Union's collapse in 91. He was kind of an overseer of a city, which doesn't pay as much as he ended up with. but there was a lot of bad dealings there, not just by him, but by other people in power, where it was a lot of bribery. Mm-hmm. And they would go in and they'd say, okay, we don't have a lot of money here, but this area that I'm in control over has got a lot of timber, and we'll sell it. And you can give me the money, by the way. And they built up their personal wealth. And then by gaining national oil companies and so forth, since he's been in office, he's probably the richest person in the world.
Yeah, that's really, whenever you analyze it that way, that just shows you how crafty he is, how deceptive he can be. And really, a lot of that is, it's wickedly smart, the way he's been able to pull off deals like that. And obviously, politics is a pretty dirty game, no matter what nation you're in. But Russia might just top the list. It's very close to the top, at least. And most of it is just because of this one man, how he has basically stepped on all throats and taken advantage of everyone he possibly can to climb to the top himself. And with the oil, as this booklet even brings out as well, he has reached out to a lot of Asian nations that are not so critical of his human rights record, and he has become the supplier to them so that if Europe ever gets belligerent toward him, he can just cut off the oil and basically their heat through the winter anytime he pleases. So he's got this alternate source of buyers for his oil in Asia, and he can just turn on Europe anytime he wants to now.
Yeah, a lot of these nations are really thinking about gaining global power in very realistic ways, like energy, sea gates, realistic things, real tangible things that everybody needs. And then, you know, in the U.S., who are squabbling over, you know, ideas and, you know, how we want to look at history.
The president is mean. He says mean things and he just doesn't get off Twitter and everyone gets outraged about it.
And all that, while you have leaders out there that are quite smart, you have to give it to them, like Vladimir Putin and others, where they're looking at, okay, how can we really gain power? And they're doing that through, like you said, control of natural gas and oil and that type of thing. If you can have the control switch and you can turn it on or off, you control that nation for the most part. Well, you don't, whether you're there militarily or not, exactly. If you can turn off their power, you're going to have a lot of say in what happens.
Yeah, and he does have basically unchecked power in the nation. He's able to operate the way he wants to. He has had interviews with prominent American journalists and has lied to their faces, or, you know, he has even laughed at them when they question him about the election, like, you know, why do I even care who's in power? I mean, either way, your president is going to be hamstrung by the media, and he's going to be hamstrung by the opposite party. I mean, look at the way the media attacks President Trump. Does it really matter who got into office in America when he's able to take advantage of the American president, no matter which party it's from? He just basically looks at the way we squabble in this country and he scoffs at it and says, well, now I'm even more glad that I don't have a media to oppose me like this. I'm even more glad that all of my political opponents are in prison, because look at the ridiculous amount of opposition that President Trump has to endure.
Yeah, that really highlights the two different ways of thinking between the West and the East in this case, because I've noticed that too, when he'll come over here and grant an interview to somebody, and the media, they maybe feel a little empowered or a little self-important, and you know they're going to really put the gotcha questions to him. He just laughs at them,
and he charms them too.
Yeah,
he's actually a pretty likable guy if you just look at his personality. He's able to tell a funny joke, he's able to make people laugh, and these reporters who come in there with the sole objective of exposing him end up kind of enamored with him in a lot of cases.
Yeah, they almost, I don't know, they sometimes the media will put questions to him, I don't know, thinking like if somehow they can catch him on something, then there'll be some sort of fallout from it. He's the prince of Rosh. He's the king over there. He doesn't care what the U.S. media will say or not say. I mean, he'll play it to his advantage, which I think he's doing very well. But this idea that, if they do an expose, like he'll fall from power or something, that's not going to happen.
Like the people will finally realize who their leader truly is, and they'll rise up and overthrow him.
Yeah.
It's not happening. He has absolute control over every branch of government, even if there even are more branches of government besides the Putin branch.
He has two arms and his two legs.
He's got all the branches connected to himself, so he doesn't have any concern about what the American media says about him. And for our media to have the hubris to think that he cares is quite outrageous in itself.
Well, and I don't know. I mean, even the people over there probably are looking at the U.S. somewhat and just shaking their head because, and we see that. I mean, even in, say, some of the recent elections in Europe, Austria, and other places, they are going to these more sort of dominant right, I guess you'd say, leaning leaders. I think people are getting a little tired of all the feel-goodery and all that, because the reality on the ground is pretty rough. Like in Europe, where you can talk about open borders all you want, but you also have terror attacks killing people. Here in America, we can talk about all of our freedoms, but we have a lot of infighting and just confusion, and none of that looks good, and it doesn't solve any problems. And so the more we're talking about, liberties and freedoms and so forth here, and people can do what they want, a lot of nations around the world seem to be rallying behind a strong leader.
Yeah, and especially when you think about how the Russians are historically very tough people. They're willing to endure extreme amounts of suffering so that their nation can advance as a world power. Even if you look at the way they view Joseph Stalin today, he killed 30 million of his own people, if that's even an accurate high estimate. I'm not even sure if it is, but a lot of the people at least view him in a nice way, despite him killing some of their family members, because during that time, at least Russia was perceived as a strong power. A lot of Russians feel that way about Vladimir Putin. Maybe he's not doing everything in an ethical manner, but he still makes the West look foolish, and I'm sure they love that.
Speaking of Stalin, I mean, he was one of the main people there at that first UN meeting. And who thinking about that, who would be surprised that it hasn't worked?
Right.
And he's a mass murderer, and he's there at the meeting for peace. Yeah, he had a way of peace. It was kill everybody that opposed you.
So
there was a lot of signs that wouldn't work. Really, another interesting part of this chapter, and again, we're just hitting the highlights. This is Russia and China and Prophecy. It's the second chapter of the book, about talking a lot about what was going on in Russia. But there's a whole situation you might remember of Kosovo's independence and the Balkans breaking up there. And Russia noticed that very much, and that factors into what they're thinking today. It says, after watching and not interfering as Germany and the U.S. sponsored Kosovo's independence, Moscow reasoned that it had the right to sponsor the independence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia from Georgia. The populations in those two breakaway regions are comprised mostly of Russian sympathizers. And if the U.S. or Europe objected, Russia could say, hey, that's what you did in Kosovo and the Balkans. You just went in and conquered the whole area. Don't accuse us for simply doing what you did. And so they've done that, and that's why we have the Ukraine situation and other ones. They looked at what Germany and the U.S. did, and they're paying us back.
Right, and that actually, what we did to help Germany in the Balkans is a big reason why the Clintons to this day are so popular over in Germany. And Bill Clinton won the Charlemagne Prize. He was the U.S. president in the 90s who basically oversaw favoring Germany in that way. That's why Germany overwhelmingly hates President Trump, because he obviously beat a Clinton to get into office. These Gentile nations seem only to like the U.S. when they benefit from our weakness, which is exactly what Germany gained. And then by America being wrong in that situation, they gave Russia all the justification it needed to then go on a conquest of its own. So how could we, as the supposed moral authority of the world, criticize Russia for doing exactly what Germany did when we backed up Germany for doing the same thing?
Yeah. So we are getting, I guess, what we are getting back what we did there in some ways. But of course, if you look at some of those areas also that Vladimir Putin went after in Ukraine and other places, there's a lot of strategic assets there. There's a lot of food production. There's oil and gas production in different areas. And so he wanted to get that back. Those are former, you know, Soviet satellites. And as he said himself, you know, he thought that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was this great catastrophe. He's trying to bring it back together again. And those nations there in the Balkans, they're always right in the middle. they're always going between Europe and Russia, and so that's always a hot spot in all the wars and everything. Mm-hmm. So when you see a lot of movement in those regions and pushes between Germany and Russia, you know that the disagreements of the past are not over. It's just a temporary respite between wars.
Right, and you do have to feel bad for those a lot of those Eastern European nations that were former Soviet satellites, really not even seen by either Europe, and most of Europe, or Russia as nations and people with families and lives. They're mostly just seen as buffer zones between the two power blocks, and they frequently get abused for that by being located where they are by no choice of their own. They are just abused for it constantly, and you see throughout history as well. Germany has to make a deal with Russia before it attacks anywhere else. They're constantly looking over each other's shoulders at each other, or looking over their shoulders at each other, trying to avoid war in Russia or vice versa before they go out and try to conquer the rest of the world.
Yeah, and that's why it's important to look at that history of World War One, World War Two, and even before then, because it does give a good indication of what you'll see happening in the future. And of course, you tie that in with Bible prophecy, and then you've got really something to look at here. And that's what's brought out here in this second chapter of Russia and China in Prophecy. It goes into more detail about the Ukraine crisis, which is probably the most recent crisis, I guess. We don't have time to get into all that today, and it's just you need to sit down and study it, because it takes time to think about all of that and remember it. And talks also about Russia and Germany behind the scenes, what you were mentioning there, Grant, about how they do make deals. There's some pretty good indication they probably have already made a deal to some extent as they go about trying to expand their empires. And so there's a lot there to look at. A scripture that is used here to really tie all of this together is Daniel 11, verses 40 through 45, which if you have time, it's good to look at that. And it talks about all these powers in the end and how they clash and how they fight and the sequence of things in a world war. And a little further down in that passage, it says, "But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him." That's that European Union, Germany, being troubled by somebody coming out of the east and the north of, if you look at Jerusalem, that's always the center for directions. And you don't have to be real good at geography to to know who's coming to trouble them. And it happened in World War II as well, where, you know, here comes Russia and China, and you can expect to see that again, according to Daniel.
History always repeats itself, and what we've seen in past world wars were usually farcical pacts between Russia and Germany before they looked elsewhere and tried to conquer elsewhere. And prophecy shows that's going to happen again, because in that passage you bring out, America, England, Judah are not even mentioned. Basically what happens is Germany just wipes out the king of the south led by Iran. They then turn their attention to the kings of the east, Russia and China, and the powers allied with them. Where are these other Western powers? Where are our nations in that? What has happened is that Germany has made peace with Russia, and then they've gone and wiped out America. So you just see pretty clearly that they always like to have that strategy. They have other targets that take priority over each other. They want to dominate their own regions and expand elsewhere before facing each other. But eventually, those two powers are the only ones left standing, the king of the north and the kings of the east. And they have to defeat each other to take over the entire world.
Yeah, there's a lot there to look at and to study more in-depthly. And it's the Russia part of it, and Germany here also is talked about in the second chapter of Russia and China and prophecy. Just last little bit here, it says, the tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him, the united Europe. And that means the frightening news coming from the northeast. Look at any world map and you can see who is located there, Russia and China, which will soon unite. And that's where the rise of Russia and China and some of those nations there in the east, and the rise of Germany and Europe, and the fall of the United States, the weakening of the U.S., the United Kingdom, Israel in the Middle East, that's where it's leading to. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to really check out here. It couldn't be any more relevant for right now because of all the things that are happening. Make sure you check out Russia and China and Prophecy. It's a free book there at thetrumpet.com, and we'll keep looking at it. A lot more to talk about with that throughout this week as well. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us today. Hopefully you have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.